Welcome to the Beanpot. I'm your host, Adam Drinkwater. Games are a part of our life. It's an essential component to our human development. Adults play with babies, children play with children. In every stage of our development, we learn new skills by playing new games. We learn how to act and interact. We're taught values, social interaction, and morality through games. We single out cheaters, and we applaud sportsmanship. Make a list of human activities, and it's easy to see how those events can easily be classified as games. Word games, head games, competitive games, social games, and political games. My guest today is author Andrew Marinus, and his new book is Games of Deception, the true story of the first U.S. Olympic basketball team at the 1936 Olympics in Hitler's Germany. This is the true story of the invention of a game, created by a thoughtful man named James Naismith. He wanted people to be the best they could be, and he believed exercise and healthy competition brought people together. And it's the story of evil men who used the Olympic Games, basketball, and propaganda to distract the world from the horrible things they were doing. In this interview, Andrew and I talk about the prominent role that competitive sports and sports writers played in his own life. We discuss how he overcame the challenges of moving to the South as a teenager, in part by meeting and writing about Perry Wallace, the first African-American to play basketball in the Southeastern Conference, and who would later be the subject of Andrew's first book, Strong Inside. We focus on James Naismith's invention of basketball and the growth of the game. That leads us into the dark, real-life characters on both sides of the ocean that were behind the lies of the Nazi propaganda effort to host the Olympics. Fortunately, there are also great heroes and powerful lessons that we cover throughout the conversation. His books are available in print and ebook. His website is andrewmarinus.com. You can find him on Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, and Twitter. I'll include links to these in the show notes. I thoroughly enjoyed this book, and I hope that you enjoy this conversation with Andrew Marinus. Well, thanks again for being on the podcast.
Oh, I'm excited to do it, Adam. It's been great to have an excuse to catch up with you. You know, it's been a long time.
Yeah, it has been. I was thinking about when we first met and when we worked together at McNeely, Pagan & Fox. And the thing that I always remember about you is how kind and patient and easy to work with you were, especially with moody designers like me.
That's the key, man.
But you are always great to work with, and I also remember how much you love sports. And you love sports from an early age, right?
That's right. Growing up, I think that some of the closest or the deepest memories I have of my grandfather, my dad, were like going to games together or watching games on TV. I was a kid that got Sports Illustrated every week, you know, and look forward to that being in the mailbox. When I was 13 years old, I started my own sports magazine, trying to copy Sports Illustrated. Even going back before that, when I was five, my parents say that I really learned how to read by reading baseball cards. My grandfather had sent me my first set of baseball cards in 1975 when I was 5 years old, and I would sort those out, you know, by teams and then by colors of uniforms or hats or whatever. And so when I was 12, 13, we lived in Washington, D.C. My dad got us season tickets to Georgetown basketball back when Patrick Ewing was playing there, and those were exciting games. We'd go up to the see the Baltimore Orioles whenever the Milwaukee Brewers, which is, I'm from Wisconsin, so whenever the Brewers came to town to play the Orioles, we'd be there to watch games. Or if the Packers came to play the Redskins, we'd go see those games. So sports was always a big part of my life as a spectator. And then as a player, I was always, you know, playing basketball at the Boys and Girls Club or baseball. And loved playing baseball. Played that through high school. And so, you know, the fact that I'm writing about sports now, it has a lot of roots in what I was interested in as a little kid.
The magazine that you started, how old were you when you started that?
I was 13, and it was called AJ's Sports Journal, and I wrote about my favorite teams, you know, the Brewers and the Packers. And then I conducted the first interview that I ever did was for that magazine, and it was with John Feinstein, who's a well-known author now and journalist, has written probably the best-selling sports books of all time. At that time, he was a friend of my father. My dad has a long career at the Washington Post, and John was a reporter there at that time. And so I interviewed him, and I tried to sell my magazine for $1.75, you know, and I still have it. So nobody even bought my one copy of my magazine. But that's what I where I got started, really, writing about sports. And then in high school, we moved to Austin, Texas, and I played baseball there and was the sports editor of our high school newspaper. And one day I saw a poster on the wall of the high school advertising a full tuition scholarship to Vanderbilt, which I had never heard of before. I'd never been to Nashville before. And it was for high school sports writers, because one of the great old sports writers of all time, Grantland Rice, was a Vanderbilt alum, as was Fred Russell, who was the sports editor at the Nashville Banner for 50 years. And so they created a full tuition scholarship in honor of those two alums. And I applied for it. And one day my mom came running up to the school and she was crying. And I didn't know why she was there, why she was crying. And she was crying with happiness that the school had called and said, your son has won this full tuition scholarship to Vanderbilt. And so that's how I ended up coming to Nashville, was on that sports writing scholarship.
So when you were in Texas, that was your first experience with living in the South.
Yes.
What was that transition like for you?
It was tough, and it was something I was not prepared for at all. I remember we moved down from the D.C. area to Austin in the summer. First of all, just stepping out of the car, arriving in Austin, Texas, in the middle of August, and it was 110 degrees. That was a shock. And then I remember when school started, a lot of the kids were wearing cowboy boots to school, or sort of these starched white shirts and cowboy hats to the football games. And I felt like a fish out of water for sure. And kids were calling me a Yankee. And I had never even really heard that term before. So all of that was a surprise to me, and a little bit tough to fit into at first. But Texas is kind of its own animal also, mm-hmm. you know, so even coming from Austin to Nashville was sort of experience a different aspect of the South when I arrived here as a freshman. And initially I didn't like it at all. I did not like Vanderbilt. I did not like Nashville that first year. But then I grew to love it, you know, and I've lived here ever since. So it's a place that has really grown on me, and it's this place that has grown in a lot of ways too. Nashville doesn't really resemble the Nashville that I moved to in 1988, for better in some ways and for worse in other ways.
When do you think that your feelings about the South began to change? Do you remember a moment?
Yeah. Well, the first time that I really became interested in just thinking about the South relates to my writing, and it relates to sports also. So my sophomore year here, I read an article in a student magazine about Perry Wallace, who was a Vanderbilt basketball player in the late 1960s, who was the first African-American basketball player in the SEC. And I read an article about the first game he ever played at Mississippi State as a freshman, and how he thought he was going to get shot and killed just for stepping onto the basketball court. You know, and I was taking a Black history class at that time at Vandy, and I asked my professor if I could write a paper about Perry for her class, and I was afraid she was going to say no, that you can't just write about sports or basketball in college, that's not serious enough academics. But thankfully she said, yes, if that's what you want to do, you should do it. And so I called Perry, wrote this paper, and it was through the research on that paper and learning about what was Nashville like when Perry was growing up, what was the Deep South like when he was traveling to these basketball games, and how that related to the civil rights era, civil rights movement, to the history of the South and the present of the South, that I really sort of became interested in the region, you know, in the people and the events that had taken place there. And so I don't necessarily think that my view of the South has like dramatically changed for the better or for the worse since then, but it's something that I certainly pay a lot more attention to. You know, I see the terrible aspects of Southern history and racism that still exists, but I see even Perry himself would say that he felt much more warmth when he was here from some pockets of people than he did when he was at Columbia University in New York City going to law school. You know, and because people in the South had lived so closely together, you know, that there was sort of an interest in getting to know each other, which he didn't feel in New York, where people may have been politically more tolerant, at least in what they said they believed in, but yet wouldn't make any effort to try to get to know him either. You know, and so he had a really nuanced view of differences in Southern culture and other parts of the country. And I tried to learn as much as I could just from talking to Perry about those types of things.
Would you say that Perry Wallace became a hero to you?
Yeah, I would say so. I interviewed him for the first time when I was 19 years old, and then ended up starting to write a biography about him 17 years later, and spent 8 years working on that book. The book has now been out for 5 years. It's called Strong Inside. And so over those years, I really began to admire so much about Perry. And yet, when I was working on the book, I also felt like I needed to keep a little bit of a journalistic detachment from him, you know, and if you're going to write a true story about someone, you can't become so close to them that you'd be hesitant to write something that maybe is not flattering about them, you know. And so I felt like I needed to have that approach to it. But after the book came out, I didn't have to worry about that anymore. And we became even closer friends. And someone that I admire is probably the most courageous, bravest, most thoughtful, wise person that I ever had a chance to be around. He died 2 years ago.
Did he get to see, he got to see the book release then?
Yes, he did. And that was a great feeling. And, you know, when the book first came out in December 2014, we did an event together in Washington, D.C., where he lives, where my parents live. And so it was a really supportive crowd, you know. And then we were about to fly down to Nashville to do the second event together. And he hasn't spent much time here since his college days. And so he turned to me and he said, "I think we're headed into a hot environment." And it was December, so he wasn't talking about the weather. he was remembering, you know, when he was a senior in college, the day after his last game, he told the truth about how difficult his experience had been. And a lot of people didn't want to hear it. And he was essentially run out of town. So coming back to Nashville and knowing that we were going to tell a lot of these same stories, he was concerned about what the reaction might be. You know, are people going to be hostile and shoot the messenger again, kind of like they did in 1970? And me, having lived in Nashville for decades and sort of seeing the changes here, was really hopeful that he would see a new Nashville, you know. And when we walked into the downtown library auditorium, there's 200 people in there, and he received a standing ovation. You know, that really sort of set a tone for this reaction that he received, which was full of love, you know, and respect, and people crying when they came up to him and asking for his forgiveness that they hadn't done more to support him back in those days. So it was really powerful, and I was really happy that Perry got to experience that, even though it came maybe 40 years after it should have. At least he was able to feel that warm reception in the last 3 or 4 years of his life.
Mm-hmm. And some validation too, that his cause was worth it, that the struggle and the pain was worth it.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. People would ask him, "Would you do it all over again? If you had a chance to be the Jackie Robinson of the SEC again, would you do it?" And I think most people hoped that he would say, "Yes, of course, I would do it all over again." But his honest answer was no, you know, and that he knew how sort of dangerous this whole experiment was, you know, and it really was sort of an experiment back then. And, you know, the first African-American player at Auburn committed suicide a couple years after leaving school there. And this was a very difficult challenge to be a pioneer, be the only person that really understands what you're up against. But he said that it was worth it in the sense if other people could learn from it, that that's what made it all worthwhile. And so I think he felt that having the chance to tell his story for the book people to read a book and really learn everything about what this entailed was a teaching moment, and that's what made it worthwhile. And so he was able to see that come to fruition.
Hmm. When you wrote that book, you initially wrote it as a book for adults.
Yes.
But then you wrote a second version for young adults. How did that come about?
Yeah, so it wasn't something that I initially planned, but sometimes things happen by accident that turn out to change your life, you know? And so I happened to walk into a coffee shop in Hillsborough Village in Nashville called Fido. And there was a woman sitting there doing an interview with a newspaper reporter. And I knew the reporter, Keith Ryan Cartwright. And I didn't know who he was talking to, but he introduced us. And he said, "Andrew, this is Ruta Sepetys. She's an author. You guys are both authors in Nashville. You should know each other." And Ruta writes historical fiction for young adults. She's a number one best-selling author in that genre. She's amazing. And she's also really just a generous, kind person. And so she interrupted her interview where she's promoting her own book to ask me questions about my book, you know, and after 10 minutes of explaining the story, she said, "I think that kids need to know that story too." Mm. And so with her endorsement, like literally sending my book into her editor in New York, they read it. And I think because she had sort of vouched for it, they took it seriously, you know? And so Philomel, which is part of Penguin, I worked with them to create a young reader's edition of Strong Inside for middle school and high school kids, which gave me a chance over the last 3+ years to go into schools in 25 states around the country, telling a story of basketball and racism and civil rights, you know? And so through that, I felt really good about this chance to go into schools and try to get kids interested in reading, first of all, and to try to find the kids who maybe are interested in sports but don't know that they might like books too, you know, and sort of have a good nonfiction, interesting, important sports story that they can read that maybe will turn them on to reading. And so I've decided with my future books, and I had one that just came out last month, to write for kids from the outset, you know, and rather than in a book for adults that I would adapt for kids. And so my new book is called Games of Deception. It's also sports nonfiction about the first U.S. Olympic basketball team at the 1936 Olympics in Nazi Germany. And I've written it in a way that I think adults and kids will like. It's just a little shorter than a typical adult book. The chapters are pretty fast paced and relatively short. But I think with people's attention spans these days, that works just as well for adults too.
It worked for me, that's for sure.
Yeah. So for the last month, I've been visiting schools again with this new story, which I'm really excited about. And I feel like I've sort of found my niche now is writing this type of nonfiction sports history for kids, and this type of books I would have liked to have read when I was a kid myself.
How do kids respond when you come to their schools and bring this story of the first Olympic basketball team?
They've responded great, and they did with Strong Inside too. And part of it is, I think it's interesting for them just to have an author come into their school, first of all, you know, regardless of what the topic is. There was a little girl in North Carolina last week that was just basically jumping up and down and about to pee in her pants. She was so excited. There was an author in her school. I'm usually invited by librarians who are, you know, trying to get their kids, first of all, just to come into the library and to pick up books and to read books. And having an author there to talk about how you even create a book, I think a lot of times can be inspiring to those kids to read more. In some cases, they've already read my book before I come in. Other cases, it's me sort of telling the story to them for the first time. And my favorite part is the questions. Kids they ask brilliant questions, you know, and sometimes, you know, this as an interviewer, even the simplest questions can be the most profound sometimes, you know, and so I always tell them not to worry about like trying to come up with the fanciest question in the world. Let's just talk about the story and what it's like to write a book. And hopefully there'll be a lot of future authors coming out of these classrooms that I've had a chance to visit.
I think for myself, your book re-inspired or helped me rediscover my own love of basketball.
Really?
Yeah. I've always been a sports fan. I love sports growing up too. Growing up in central PA, we weren't very far from Philadelphia. And so I played soccer and lacrosse in high school and loved playing basketball just for fun. And I was a big 76ers fan. Players like Charles Barkley and Allen Iverson were playing when I was growing up. I missed, unfortunately, the 1 year that the Sixers have had a championship because I was like 6 years old or something. I had no idea what was going on then. But I loved it. I love those kinds of players, those blue collar, hardworking, give it 100% players.
Yes.
Those were my, I guess, sports heroes, basketball heroes were players like them. And then moving to Nashville, still continue. I went to Vandy games. I went to NCAA tournaments, really enjoyed those experiences, came to a university town where we have, a really fun basketball team, an amazing, arena. But as an adult now, having kids, we kind of got away from going to games, kind of got away from enjoying, those events and feeling that passion again. But when I read the book, I was inspired, one, from just the inventor, the creator of the game, James Naismith. Just that story alone kind of reinvigorated my interest in the game.
That's great.
Tell me about how his story helped inspire this book.
Yeah, so this book, you know, it's titled Games of Deception, and it's about the first Olympic basketball team in the 36 Olympics, but it's also about the invention of the game. How did it grow from one gymnasium to be played in so many countries around the world that it could be in the Olympics just 45 years later? And so I was actually in Lawrence, Kansas, to speak about Strong Inside 3 years ago, and had never been there before. Being a college basketball fan, I really wanted to see Allen Fieldhouse while I was in town. And so I took a tour there, and in the arena, they have Naismith's original rules of basketball. So when he invented basketball in 1891, he had a woman at the school type out the rules, and they have those pieces of paper there under glass, kind of like you might see the Constitution or something in D.C., you know? And next to it, they had a picture of Naismith with some Japanese basketball players from the 1930s. And the guy who was showing me around said, "Did you realize the inventor of basketball was able to see his sport debut at the Olympics?" And I didn't know that. And I asked him, "Which Olympics was it?" And when he said it was the 36 Olympics in Berlin, I knew I had the subject for my next book. So I went up to Almonts, Ontario, Canada, where Naismith was born, where he grew up. I saw the house that he grew up in. There's a museum with a lot of artifacts from his early life. And then I went to Springfield College in Massachusetts, where he went to graduate school and where he was one of many students from around the world that were there to be trained to run YMCAs around the world. And these guys would play baseball in the spring and football in the fall, but they were really bored in the winter. They had nothing to do in a world before basketball, you know? And so there was a teacher that challenged someone in the class to come up with a new game. And Naismith raised his hand. He had 2 weeks to complete his assignment. Like any college student, he waited till the night before it was due. And then invented basketball in his mind that night, you know? And then the next morning, you know, like the legend goes, the custodian nailed a peach basket 10 feet off the ground because that's the elevation of the running track that circled the gym. That's still why there's a hoop 10 feet off the ground today. Nothing more magical to it than that, you know, and that was the invention of basketball. And Naismith really saw it as he was interested in it mostly as a form of exercise, you know, not really as a spectator sport, a tournament sport like we think of it today. But it was his protege, Fog Allen, who Allen Fieldhouse is named after, who was the Kansas coach for so long, that really pushed for things like the creation of the NCAA tournament and for basketball to be included in the Olympics. And he worked for years to try to get that done. Initially thought that it would happen in the 32 Olympics in Los Angeles, but ultimately was successful in lobbying German Olympic officials and actually Nazi officials to get basketball included in the 36 Olympics. And Naismith, who, and then by then was in his mid-70s, was able to sail to Berlin and see this game he had invented in Springfield College, played by more than 30 countries in the 36 Olympics.
I never really paid much attention to the 36 Olympics. I remember that Jesse Owens, that was his debut. He was a college athlete at that point. Is that right?
And yes, he had been a star at Ohio State, and he won 4 gold medals in those Olympics.
And that's usually what comes to mind when I think about the Nazi Olympics.
Right.
But now, as an adult, I can actually see that there was a much bigger problem with that event. And it almost didn't happen. The U.S. team almost didn't go, or at least there was an attempt to boycott those Olympics. Why was that?
Yes. So, and that was a surprise to me as I was doing the research. I didn't realize before how strong the boycott effort was in the United States. And this was because people were beginning to learn about Adolf Hitler and what was happening in Germany, and persecution of political opponents and of Jews there. And so a lot of people felt like, how can we go participate in this athletic tournament that's supposed to be about the best of humanity and bringing people together, and sportsmanship, fair play, in Adolf Hitler's Germany? You know, it just doesn't make sense. And so you had 100,000 people march through the streets of New York protesting Hitler and the idea of going to those Olympics. There were many religious leaders that were speaking out against it. There was a basketball team at Long Island University who was the best college basketball team in the country and could have likely qualified to become part of the U.S. Olympic team. The way they did it, where they determined the basketball team that year, was to have a tournament where the two best teams that made it to the championship were combined to become the U.S. Olympic basketball team. And so one of those teams that likely could have made it to that championship game was Long Island University, but they took a vote as a team to boycott the qualifying tournament. And so I think sometimes people will say in retrospect, we didn't really have an idea of what was happening in Nazi Germany at that time. It wasn't until much later that we really figured it out, but there were even college basketball teams that had a good sense of what was happening there and refused to play in the qualifying tournament. And on the other hand, though, you had people like Avery Brundage, who was the head of the American Olympic Committee at that time. And I visited his archives at the University of Illinois and read a lot about him. And I don't think there's any question that he was an anti-Semitic person himself. And he admired the Nazis, you know, and didn't really have a problem with sending the U.S. Olympic team there, and in fact was writing letters to Nazi officials asking them to send quote-unquote positive news coverage of the Nazi regime to American newspapers to try to balance out the negative coverage of the Nazis that were there. And he had sort of a personal selfish financial motivation to make sure that we participate in those Olympics also, because his construction firm was scheduled to build a new German embassy in Washington, D.C. And so he couldn't afford to upset the German government or he'd lose that contract. You know, so he was really a conflicted, compromised person in a big leadership position. But, you know, the other interesting thing I found out in the research was, even though sort of politically people understood why we should not participate in those Olympics, even Jewish athletes and African-American athletes who could see the racism and the anti-Semitism in Germany a lot more clearly than a lot of other Americans still decided they would participate. You know, there was Sam Balter, who was the one Jewish member of the U.S. basketball team, who had a big decision to make after his team qualified to go to the Olympics. And that was he going to go to Berlin, knowing what he did at that time? And he decided the best thing he could do was to go, to perform well, to win a gold medal, and that in his mind, that would be the best way to refute Hitler, was through his own personal excellence, you know, and that's what Jesse Owens decided also. And so, you know, you might have people thinking one way politically, but when it came to an actual athlete as their one chance to compete in the Olympics, they made different decisions than you might imagine. And I thought that was interesting to explore.
Yeah, that was interesting to me too, how they each looked at the Olympics as they looked at it differently. Some of them as opportunities and some of them looked at it as something so evil that they couldn't be a part of it.
Yeah. And so I thought it was important because I think the people who made a decision not to go were right also, you know? And so I put the names of those Long Island University basketball players in the book because they've kind of been lost to history by making, I think, the right decision, but we don't remember them at all, you know? And so I purposely put all those names of the basketball players in the book so they could get maybe some deserved recognition all these years later.
Yeah, I really appreciated that. We do miss out on the people that make a stand or get lost because they weren't the names that were that people recognized, like the Jesse Owens. Not that what he faced wasn't insurmountable, or what he did is invalidated by his choice. It's good to remember all of the people and why they made those choices, because it's part of the whole conversation.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And it's really important to look at what people's motivations were so that they become three-dimensional, real human beings, you know?
Not just a caricature.
Yes, exactly. And I think, you know, that's one of the points, I think, of your whole podcast is to really show that, you know, because I think we lose that a lot in polarized times, you know, and we don't really take the time to understand each other.
Good
why
point.
People make certain decisions that they make.
Yeah, very good point. Interesting that the Nazis were so good at propaganda that even when they were beaten by people like Jesse Owens, they tried to spin it to their benefit.
Oh, right. So they could spin anything. And that was the whole purpose of the Olympics, really, was to be a propaganda tool, you know, to try to fool the world into believing that maybe the negative things they had heard about what were happening there wasn't true, you know. And so the reason the book is called Games of Deception is because these whole Olympic Games were meant to deceive, you know, and the city itself was really spruced up for the Olympics sort of false ways. It was like a movie set that had just been set up for those 2 weeks in August. The whole culture was built on lies and propaganda. There was a feature on Joseph Goebbels, the high propaganda minister in the New York Times leading up to the Olympics, where he basically admitted the truth was irrelevant to him. And what really mattered is, did what he say work? You know, did it fool people? Did it get them to do what he wanted? And if it was the truth or not, it didn't matter. And so what you're referring to is, and it was Americans that were saying similar things to the Nazis. But if, say, an African-American athlete lost, they would say, see, you know, they're inferior. If African-American or Jewish athlete won, they would say, see, they have unfair advantage because they're naturally sort of rawer humans. You know, it was really racist language that they were using, but they could spin it either way and say the U.S. had an unfair advantage by even letting its black athletes compete in the Olympics, and that they would never do that. It was, you know, the famous, largely apocryphal story of Hitler refusing to shake Jesse Owens' hand. But there was an incident where a Nazi PR official asked Hitler if he would pose for a picture with Jesse Owens. They thought that would be good propaganda to have him there together, and he refused to do that. He wouldn't do that.
And they also used Jewish, German Jews in their propaganda efforts. There was one woman in particular that really touched me. Mrs. Bergman?
Gretel Bergman. Gretel Bergman.
Yeah.
She was a great high jumper and was Jewish, and her parents had gotten her out of Germany a few years before the Olympics, sort of sensing what was happening, but then the Germans sort of were under a lot of international pressure to show that they weren't discriminating against Jewish athletes. And so what they did was invite a couple of Jewish athletes to participate in the German Olympic trials, even though most people felt that this was sort of a fraud. You know, they were only allowing them to compete in the trials for PR purposes, but wouldn't let them really be on the team. And Bergman was a world-class high jumper. She should have been on the team, and they allowed her to continue trying out until the point the U.S. Olympic team set sail for Germany. By the time it was too late for us to protest, we were already on the boat to Germany. It was at that point that they sent Gretel Bergman a letter saying that she was not, you know, going to be on the team, but she could buy standing room only tickets, you know, and it was signed Heil Hitler. And that was quite an insult to Gretel Berg, who ended up living into her 100s, she eventually emigrated to the United States, and I always felt like she had been robbed of her chance to compete in the Olympics.
Yeah, and you quoted her as saying that the only reason she was robbed of that opportunity was purely an accident of birth, just being born Jewish.
Yeah, and that's such an apt description of anti-Semitism, of racism, of what has robbed so many people of opportunities, you know, all over the world. Something she had absolutely nothing to do with. She was born herself, you know, and deserved that opportunity like so many other people did.
Avery Brundage, you quote him as saying, "When we let politics, racial questions, religious or social disputes creep into our actions, we're in for trouble and plenty of it." That was part of his argument of why we shouldn't boycott the Olympics.
Yeah, he was saying that we shouldn't meddle in the affairs of another country, that politics and sports should be kept separate, which the hypocrisy of saying that was that, so first of all, we shouldn't meddle in the affairs of another country. He was literally writing letters to Nazis, encouraging them to send information to the United States, right?
Yeah.
So he was meddling in his own country, encouraging the meddling in his own country. The second, the idea of sports and politics not mixing. The Olympics are a perfect example of how sports and politics have always been sort of mixed together. The Olympics are largely a political event as much as they are an athletic event. The Hitler was happy to host the Olympics because of the political implications. First of all, showing his own people that, see, the world is fine coming here. You know, the world respects us. Look, they're all coming here for the Olympics. And there was internal propaganda that was going on. And then even more important was the sort of external propaganda of having the world visiting his Berlin. And again, trying to, there was a concentration camp that had already been opened 15 miles from the Olympic Village. And the whole idea of the Olympics was to distract from that kind of thing and just have a really hospitable, fun, colorful environment for the Olympics so that the world would kind of take the pressure off, the heat off of Germany and say, oh, things are really just fine there. And of course, you know, it took several years before the United States entered World War II, 6 million people killed in the Holocaust. You wonder how things might have turned out differently had we taken it more seriously years earlier. And I think that's what a boycott would have indicated, is that there was more skepticism of Hitler and of Germany at that point, and more international pressure being applied to them, as opposed to leaders like Brundage, who actually admired the Nazis and encouraged us to participate and kind of took the heat off of them for years, and how many people died in those intervening years.
So both sides of the boycott really centered around the contrast of American values versus this one big advertisement for Nazism.
Yeah, and there was a dispute about what were American values, you know, and you had some people saying freedom of speech, freedom of religion, free elections are American values, and those were people that were opposed to the Olympics. You had other people that accused the boycott proponents of being un-American, you know, and where were their loyalty? Why were they standing up for these Jews in Europe? You know, and so there was sort of the anti-Semitism there, and the the anti-Semitic people in the United States that really weren't that opposed to what was happening there at that point in history. And I think a lot of times we think about the result of World War II and how the United States sort of saved the day and defeated Hitler, liberated the concentration camps. And we think maybe that everybody was 100% bought into that from the very beginning. And what you see when you do your understanding of history and reading letters to the Brundage that were signed, Heil Hitler, Heil Brundage, telling the Jewish Americans to mind their own business, and that otherwise that what was going to happen to them is what had happened to the Jews in Germany. You know, it was really shocking for me to read these letters in newspaper columns from that side of the issue.
There was a lot of irony in the book, or you pointed out a lot of irony in the conversations and what was going on with the Olympics. And I think one of those ironies that stood out to me was just that both in the U.S. and Germany, neither one of those places were free and open to all races.
Yeah, I read a great book called Hitler's American Model. It's written by James Whitman, who's a professor at Yale. The former athletic director at Vanderbilt, David Williams, who was a law professor, had read this book. Because the point of the book is to show how the Nazis, early in their regime, were looking for the most racist laws in the world as they were developing their Nuremberg laws, which were the laws that stripped Jews of citizenship and determined, you know, how much blood you had in you, whether that made you Jewish or not, or Aryan. And so they were looking for examples of these types of laws around the world, and they found the most racist laws in the United States. They sent one of their law students to the University of Arkansas to study American race law, you know, and that was really surprising to me, eye-opening to me, to see how, you know, they borrowed some of what we consider the evilest part of their regime from us. I saw examples, half of this U.S. Olympic basketball team came from a town in Kansas called McPherson, Kansas. And I found a picture of the KKK marching through the streets of McPherson when I was doing the research. The previous Olympics before 36 were held in Los Angeles in 1932. And I found articles about a year before those Olympics, 1931, the deportation of 1 million Mexican Americans from Los Angeles. So you're about to invite the world to celebrate all the countries of the world in your city in a year before you're for no other reason than they were brown skinned, you know, sending 1 million American citizens back to Mexico. At the time of the 36 Olympics, there was federal anti-lynching legislation in Congress, you know, to make lynching a federal crime, and it couldn't get through Congress because of racist senators that were blocking it. And so, yeah, a big part of the book is to show that at that point in history, there were a lot of similarities between Germany and the United States. And maybe we don't want to confront that too often or really to think about it, but I think it's important history to understand it. So it helps you understand why people were making the decisions they did back then. And then also, I think any good history causes you to think about the world you live in today. And so, you know, that was another reason why I thought that was important to write about in the book, because you still see the echoes of that, obviously, today.
And am I right that the Olympic Committee had a rule in place that African Americans could be, or blacks could be, in individual sports, but they couldn't be on team sports?
Yes, and I don't know if that was like a written rule, or it was certainly the attitude, right? Okay. And so, there in team sports, the way they formed the teams back then was you didn't try out as an individual. You know, the famous Boys in the Boat book about the rowing team at the 36 Olympics, that was the University of Washington's crew team. The basketball team, as I mentioned, was created by combining the two best amateur teams in the country. And so the Olympic officials, who were all white men, were not going to permit entire African-American teams to represent the United States. Whereas the idea of, you know, a single track athlete here or there, or boxer here or there, was more palatable to them. So that's why you had athletes like Jesse Owens competing in track, but you had no black basketball players on the basketball team.
Hmm. Well, of the players that did make the Olympic team, there are some really interesting characters and names. One that comes to mind is Frank Lubin.
Frank Lubin, yes.
Lubin,
yes.
The Frankenstein Lubin.
Yes. So what I mentioned, these two teams that were combined, one of them came from Hollywood. The guys worked at Universal Pictures, and they were the studio's basketball team. The guy that created the team there, his name was Jack Pierce. He was the head makeup artist at the studio. And they really used this basketball team as a way to promote their movies. When they traveled from town to town playing games, Pierce would dress up the players in the costumes of some of the big movie characters at the time, one of whom was Frankenstein. That was a Universal movie. And Frank Lubin was the tallest player on the team. And so before games, Jack Pierce would dress him up. He put the green paint on him, just like Frankenstein, and the whole Frankenstein costume. And he would come out and entertain the crowd for the games, and then as the game got started, go back to the locker room, change into his uniform, and come out and play the rest of the game. But Yeah, I thought it was really interesting how in the days before TV and internet, like how did a studio advertise its movies? One way was to create this basketball team. They went town to town, letting people know what the movies were before the basketball games.
And basketball itself was even kind of in its infancy. It was still growing in popularity. You have a couple of players, Joe Fortenberry and Willard Schmidt, who are credited with what the first ever dunks, and that came through newspaper articles, right, from an exhibition game.
Yeah, so these two guys played for the team from Kansas, and they were 6'7", 6'8", 6'9". They billed themselves as the tallest team in the world. They played the game at Madison Square Garden and were dunking the ball. The reporter from the New York Times had never seen this before, and so imagine trying to describe a dunk to your readers who have never seen it. And so he came up with sort of a comparison. He said it was like a diner customer dunking their roll in coffee. And that's where the term dunk comes from these guys that were on the first U.S. Olympic basketball team. They also, their team played a faster style of basketball than was common in those days. They ran a full court pressure defense and a fast break offense. And so they were really ahead of their time. And it was interesting to learn about the connections even between 1930s and today's game of basketball. And really you could see today's game sort of emerging through this team from Kansas.
The trip to Germany for these players, most of them were amateurs. They had to leave their jobs. They had to leave their families. Some of them even lost their jobs just to go to the Olympics. So many of them had to sacrifice just to get to Germany. Do you think that they realized how important this game would be, not only personally, but to the game of basketball?
Oh, that's a really good question. I would probably say that a lot of them, they were certainly aware that this was the first time basketball was going to be played in the Olympics, but basketball really wasn't a very big deal at those Olympics. Mm-hmm. So I don't know how much they envisioned of the future. For example, the games were all played outside. You know, it wasn't even in an arena or a basketball gym. They turned clay tennis courts into the basketball courts for those Olympics. And it worked out fine in the first few rounds when the weather was good, but the gold medal round and the bronze medal game were both played in a driving rainstorm. And so the court turned into a big mud puddle, and the ball just plopped in the mud. They couldn't dribble. The ball itself got really heavy, and so the scoring was really low. It was 19-8 was the score, which was low scoring even for those days. And so the players themselves kind of considered the Olympic tournament a bit of a joke. You know, the American players did. Naismith, on the other hand, who was there to see his invention played in the Olympics, was really proud of this moment. You know, and he had said that he always considered basketball an international game. When he had been a Canadian in the United States inventing this game, and the players at this international training school, YMCA training school in Massachusetts, were from all over the world. And here it was being played in Europe by countries from 31 countries. It was a really proud moment in his life. And I think he kind of, at that point, see how this was sort of a sport that was going to be beloved in so many countries around the world, and had a sense of the growth that might come from there. But I don't think the players thought about that too much.
I think you pointed out that he was at the Olympics, that he got to witness his sport at its peak, but he almost didn't get to watch the tournament.
Yeah, which is crazy to me. So you have the inventor of the game show up, and he shows up the first day of the basketball tournament, and they don't let him in. He expected and was told that he was going to be on a pass list, you know, as the inventor of the game to get to watch the games. But Avery Brundage had struck his name from the pass list. And so you have the inventor left out in the cold. And there were people there, basketball officials, that were really embarrassed by this. And so they hurriedly sort of scrambled and put together a sort of a miniature version of the opening ceremonies. And they had each of the country's basketball teams parade in front of Naismith and present him with a flag from their countries. And then Naismith was able to say a few words to the players. But imagine inventing a game and it's played in the Olympics and they don't let you in.
That's crazy.
It was pretty crazy. But then he was able to see all the games. He took notes and compared the styles of play from all the countries. He was obviously impressed with the Americans, who had by far the best team there. but also with a team from the Philippines he thought was really good. He thought they just didn't have the height to compete. And height really mattered then, even in some ways more than it does now, because they had a jump ball after every made basket. And so if you were a tall team who scored, you just win the jump ball and keep possession. And so that was a big advantage for the United States. And so Naismith at that time even wrote in his diary that he thought maybe someday that basketball should divide into two divisions, one for for short guys and the other for tall players. And he also always he liked that center jump after every basket. He really hoped that that would remain. It was other coaches who pushed for the way we play ball now. You score, the other team takes the ball. But Naismith said he thought the most interesting part of any sport were the moments of uncertainty. You know, is this ball going to go in? Who's going to get the rebound? You know, and so he felt like a jump ball was like, well, it was uncertainty. Who's going to win the center jump? And it was adding more of an element of surprise and uncertainty to the game. And that's why he always felt like he wanted to keep it in there. I think we're lucky that he lost out on that aspect of his original rules, though.
Yeah, and there were a couple of things that he said that really showed his heart. He saw these games as an international peace and goodwill movement. He wanted the sport to bring people together. And you make a point of bringing up in the book that some people viewed sport as a neutral thing, and others viewed it as being inherently positive. Do you lean one way or the other?
That's a really good question. And, you know, even further back than that, when Naismith was studying divinity school in Montreal in the late 1800s, sports were considered sort of an evil thing by a lot of religious leaders who felt like it was taking young men away from the church, you know, or taking them away from more serious things like their job or their family. And Naismith was playing rugby on Saturday and preaching on Sunday, you know, and they considered him a bit of an outlier. That's why he was excited to go to this school in Massachusetts that was, you know, a Christian school affiliated with the YMCA that believed in sports and believed that that was, you know, developing, becoming a healthy body, a healthy person, and competing with sportsmanship was a good thing. And that was a bit controversial at that time. People like Naismith believed sports were inherently good and taught things like sportsmanship and character and teamwork. Developing a healthy body, mind, and spirit, those types of things. You know, but when I went to the Holocaust Museum and I saw a quote there, and this was in an exhibit around the 36 Olympics, where the director of the museum pointed out that sports isn't necessarily inherently positive. It's neutral, and it depends on the people involved as to whether it produces good or bad results. You know, and so I think when you view it through that lens, you can see, well, sports didn't ensure that African Americans were able to try out for the Olympic basketball team. Sports provided Hitler a propaganda opportunity, you know, through hosting the Olympics. If you think about modern day U.S. gymnastics, sure, it's created a lot of good memories for us when we watch it, but it's also resulted in the abuse of hundreds of girls, you know, by a team doctor. And so I think it really, with the way I would lean, even as a huge sports fan, whose day job is in sports and who writes about sports and loves sports, I think I would fall on this neutral side. You know, I love the Green Bay Packers, but what's the game doing to these players' brains? So I think you can see positive aspects to sports, negative aspects too. And it really has sort of changed the way I think about it. I would go with the neutral over inherently positive.
I think it was Naismith who said, don't be afraid to work for humanity and wait for your reward.
Yes, that was a great quote and not something you might expect. I mean, in one sense, you could say just inventing a game doesn't make you like a special person necessarily or a wise person or admirable person. But Naismith was all those things. You know, I think we're lucky that it was a person of his character that invented basketball so that we can celebrate him as well as the game that he invented. And when he said that, he was talking about the fact that he just invented this game in one gymnasium in Massachusetts for one class of students, and then it turned out to be a good thing for, in his mind, for the world. It brought the world together in the Olympics for this basketball tournament. So he made that comment 45 years after he invented the game, where the countries of the world came together to play it. He was understandably proud of that moment.
If there was one lesson that you would want your readers to get from this book, what would it be?
Yeah, so with both of my books, I'm trying to use sports because sports is accessible. You know, I think a lot of people pay attention to sports. It's not a scary topic to get into or intimidating to think about reading a book about a basketball game or a basketball player. But really, the important messages of the book, I think, come from the other aspects outside of basketball. So one of my favorite characters in the book is a man that I met named Dr. Al Miller, who's 97 years old now. He lives in Cincinnati. At the time of the 36 Olympics, he was a 13-year-old Jewish kid living in Berlin, seeing the city change in really scary ways. His guys who had been his friends a week before now hated him, you know, and were bullying him just because he was Jewish. He went to those Olympics. He saw Jesse Owens win a gold medal, rode his bike to the Olympic Stadium. The next year, at age 14, his parents can kind of sense what's possibly to come, and they get him out of the country for his own safety. He comes to the United States not knowing if he'd ever see them again. He does. They're able to escape the next year. Dr. Miller enlists in the U.S. Army, serves in World War II. Because he speaks German, he's used to interrogate Nazi prisoners. And then he becomes an eye doctor in Cincinnati. And when I interviewed him, he told me that he still visits school kids twice a month in Cincinnati to talk to them about the Holocaust and the lessons to learn from it. And I asked him, well, what do you tell these kids when they ask you, well, how do we make sure nothing like this ever happens again? And he said that when that happens, he tells the students they already know the answer. And they've already stated that answer out loud that morning with their hands over their hearts, staring at the American flag. And that the most important thing to remember are the last five words of the Pledge of Allegiance, liberty and justice for all. And not to forget those last two words, for all. And that we've seen throughout history what happens when we exclude certain types of people or persecute certain people and assume that, you know, the in-group is correct, you know, and is right about everything and is the chosen group. And so he says the lesson of the Holocaust is liberty and justice for all people. And when we remember the for all part, then we're in good shape. When we forget that, we've seen what can happen. And so I think that I would hope that's the lesson that people take away from this book.
Yeah, and I'm so thankful that he was able to escape Nazi Germany, make it to the U.S., and still be here to make that quote. Really, really a special story that he had, especially in contrast to his uncle who didn't survive.
Yeah, his uncle was killed at Auschwitz. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it's amazing to see this history still alive. And we don't have too many of these people around anymore, you know, but a man who was at the 36 Olympics that saw his friends show up with swastikas on their uniforms at school, whose family was killed in the Holocaust, who is still around to sort of warn us about that road that the world went down at that time. I think it's really important to listen to those people while they're still here. I was really excited to be able to present a copy of the book to him. Mm. You know, interviewed him 2 years ago. The book just came out last month. I went to Cincinnati for an event, and he showed up, and I signed a book for him, and he signed a book for me, you know, and that was a special moment for sure.
I bet that was. Your next project, you're on a bit of a time constraint. Is that right? Your next book?
Yeah. So I'm down to the last couple of months here. I have to finish it by February. Again, it's sports and history with a bit of a social message to it. It's a biography of a Major League Baseball player named Glenn Burke. Two interesting things about him. One, he invented the high five. So if you've ever high-fived somebody, you're kind of paying tribute to Glenn Burke without knowing it. He and Dusty Baker did it in a game in 1977. But more importantly, he was the first openly gay Major League Baseball player and ended up dying of AIDS in the 1990s. He was run out of baseball by managers after they found out about his secret, you know. So it's been a really fascinating story to research. I didn't really know anything about him before I got into this. I've written the first 13 chapters. I'm about halfway through. And this will be a book for high school students and adults, and I'm really excited about it.
When do you hope to see it be released?
So what they're planning to do is have it come out in time for baseball season 2021. So I'll turn it in February of 2020. It'll come out about a year after that.
Do you have any long-term plans after that?
No, I don't. I don't have my next book figured out. I'm kind of trying to think of an idea right now. A lot of feedback I've gotten in visiting schools and with students is to do a book about a female athlete, which I think would be a great thing to do. So I'm kind of looking through different ideas there. If you or any of your podcast listeners have any ideas, I'd love to hear them. But certainly no shortage of women pioneers in sports. That would be a direction I'd lean to. So I'm open to any and all ideas.
Well, I'm really thankful that you have focused on sharing stories that that people aren't familiar with, new stories, hidden stories about figures and history in our own history that really are heroes and probably should be lifted up as heroes and remembered for their words and their actions and making the world a better place. So thank you for telling those stories and thank you for being on the podcast today.
Well, Adam, it's been a pleasure to be on the podcast, and thank you for those comments. I think there are a lot of people who have done interesting, important things that get written out of history for one reason or another, you know, and we forget their stories. And I think it's important that if you have an opportunity to share their stories and to learn from them, that we do it. You know, with Perry Wallace, he was someone I really admired from having written a paper about him as a student. And there's a quote from the late author Toni Morrison. She said, if there's a book you want to read, but it hasn't been written yet, then you must write it. You know, and I hadn't heard that quote yet, but kind of the attitude I had is I can't sit around waiting for somebody else to tell this story. You know, I'll go ahead and do it myself. And I get the sense that's kind of the attitude you have with your podcast also, is to go ahead and do it yourself. You know, talk to people, take the leap to start this project. And I'm really glad I've done that with my books. And I know you probably feel the same way with your podcast too. And but thanks for having me on.
Yeah. Thanks for that encouragement. And I look forward to your next book and hopefully we can talk about it when it gets released.
That'd be great, Adam. Thank you.
All right. Take care. Thanks. There it is. Another episode of the Beanpod. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and thank you, Andrew, for being my guest. Please order a copy of Games of Deception in print or ebook. It's an excellent gift idea for young adults. If you enjoyed this conversation, please subscribe to the podcast and give my other interviews a listen. And if you like it, please rate the show with 5 bright, shining stars. Visit my Patreon page at patreon.com/AdamDrinkwater to see how you can help support future episodes. While you're there, please take a quick poll so I can get your feedback. I honestly want your input, and this is an easy way for you to share how you think I'm doing. Don't forget, I'm running a special offer for new patrons that expires on December 20th, so don't wait. Please follow me on Twitter and Instagram at ADH2O. You can find links to those in the show notes and at adamdrinkwater.com. This show is produced, recorded, and edited by me. All music is by the very talented and gracious Lenny Trawick. Thanks for listening. I hope you'll come back.